Your stories don't define you, but how you tell them will. Hi, I'm Sarah Elkins, Chief Storymaker and your host of this podcast. We share stories for many reasons. We want to persuade, we want to entertain, and we want to connect. But what we sometimes forget is the impact of the stories we tell ourselves. Whether you're sharing personal stories or business stories, how you share them makes a difference in how you remember them and in how you're being perceived by the people you're sharing them with. In this series, you'll hear stories that will resonate with you and you'll nod your head in understanding. And then we'll dig into lessons from each of those stories. How many times have you been sharing a story only to be interrupted by a person eager to share his own? Well, when I'm working with clients on communication skills, I remind them to listen for understanding, but not to respond necessarily. But during this podcast, I'm asking you to listen and consider your related stories and think about which stories in your life might have impacted you in a similar way. Today's episode is featuring my friend Marisa Diaz-Weyan, and we're sitting here on my couch in my living room talking to each other, and I realized that with all of our conversations over the years, we could probably produce a really good episode, really relating to the stories that shape us and the pivot points that we've experienced in our lives. So I've invited Marisa to come and sit with me and have this conversation. So thank you for joining me, Marisa.
Thank you.
So I always ask my podcast guests, the very first question is to tell us something that most people don't know about you. And the reason I do this is that I like for our audience to have some sort of a different connection with you before we start getting into the personal stories. So they'll feel like they know you in some way before they start to hear your wisdom.
Okay, let's see. It can be whatever, anything.
It can be whatever. My sister told us that she pretended to hate pink when she was a little girl because I didn't like pink. So that was something most people didn't know about her.
Okay. I have no idea what it is, but I thoroughly enjoy super corny puns and corny jokes. And I look for them and I long, favorite joke still, it's not super corny, but it's still hilarious to me, is the go-to horse box walks into a bar, bartender asks why the long face. And that's just funny to me and ridiculous. Although I did just hear a really funny joke from a friend of mine, Ruslan, in California the other day. it's so lame.
You have to tell the joke.
I can't do the lead in without the joke. Why do cows have hooves and not feet?
I don't know why.
Because they lack toes. So stupid. Yeah. So I enjoy ridiculous humor. That's just one thing. There's a handful of other bizarre elements, but yes, I like.
That is so funny. I knew that you liked puns. I knew you were a language person. So anyone who is fascinated by language and interested in how we speak and the words we choose to use, generally their sense of humor runs toward puns. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Yeah. And I appreciate them. When you hear a good pun, you're like, yes.
Yes. Yeah. And so that it doesn't surprise me, but it is something that I don't think I would have picked out and said, oh, that's something most people probably don't know about Marisa. I like that very much. Well, thank you. So as we're sitting here sipping tea.
And I'm spilling.
As you're spilling tea, I'm reminded of how we met and those interesting pivot points that we experience when we meet new people, that we get these unexpected connections that end up being like a forever connection. And I was working at the City of Helena as a public affairs person, and you were calling the city to get a permit for an event that you were planning for your nonprofit.
Yes, I remember that.
And I walked you through how to get the permit. And I remember getting off the phone after our conversation because you were asking me other questions and I was trying to kind of point you towards some other resources, people that you could contact. And I remember getting off the phone thinking, I'm going to have to meet that woman. I think she's going to have a big impact somewhere in this town, and I'll be really interested to meet her. So do you remember how that changed?
Yeah, I do. And I think, and I can't remember if we... if I called back and then we ended up having a longer conversation, or if it actually was just a really long conversation from the beginning that went completely off of the event and more just about, what are you about? What are your name? This, what, you know, like, what do you do?
Yeah. This is so cool. What's meaningful to you?
Yeah. I think it just sort of naturally developed into that. It just says like we were already friends, old friends already. Yes. It was really interesting.
And I remember you showed up in my office to deliver posters for the event so that you could meet me and so that I could have some of these posters. So I would make sure to share them with some more of the resources in town that I knew I could get a hold of. And I remember being really fascinated by your organization, which is called Merlin CCC. So what does the CCC stand for?
So actually the final C has a name to it now. For a while, it's gone through some evolutions of this organization, but it stands for collaboration, consult, and community, the three C's. So the collaboration is largely about the approach, I think, that we try to take. It's very cross-disciplinary. I like to think innovative and certainly very inclusive. Mm-hmm. And then the consult would be certain services that we offer. And then the community is absolutely the base and core of everything that we do. Activities.
So tell me what Merlin does. I mean, what's the mission? What's the purpose of this organization?
So my lovely elevator pitch, which is still, I'm still tweaking.
And you will be forever. That's how that works.
Yes. And philosophy is a hard one to get an elevator pitch for. Mm-hmm. But in general, our organization is really about trying to enrich lives and strengthen the community and environment through philosophy, and through the application and activity of doing philosophy.
Cool. I remember one of the first events that I went to was a philosophy think and drink at the little bar in downtown Helena.
That's right.
And I remember being fascinated because I've never been a big reader of philosophy or philosophers, although I've read a lot of literature that obviously embody a lot of what we talked about at that night in particular. And I remember being struck by how applied philosophy could be to current events. And it's not something I had really considered before. Is that something you come across a lot, trying to explain that?
Yeah, yes. And I think oftentimes, or at least my experience is, in sort of academic settings or the way philosophy is taught, oftentimes it's taught is a little more removed from life than
like math.
Yeah. right, which has obviously very practical
applications. Right.
But yeah, so I do think that that's an unfortunate thing. To me, I've had the luxury in many ways of having some amazing professors, and my father as well, who really held philosophy to be something closer to philosophy as a way of life, which is kind of what many of the ancient philosophers thought of as philosophy, which is this thing that will help us navigate our everyday lives. And so it can't get much more practical.
Right,
than
particularly
that.
When it comes to morality and ethics.
Yes.
I think that's the big thing that we clearly see a need to understand and apply philosophy to those particular areas.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's been a steady throughout. The other things certainly apply as well, but sometimes you have to do a little more digging to see how they're relevant, but they are.
Yeah. And more relevant.
Yes.
As we see things like all of the stories right now about Facebook unethically sharing information about their users and how those government organizations have been able to manipulate people through social media. So I think the applications of philosophy, particularly ethics, are very big right now. If we can just start talking about what that means and why it matters. I mean, I think some people don't think that it matters, that these issues are, it's up to an individual to figure this out. But as long as we're not talking about it, those individuals aren't even going to know that something was wrong in the first place.
Yeah, and I think maybe to add to that as well, I think oftentimes as a culture, we tend to get caught up in the how. How do I get this done? I'm moving from point A to point B. But we don't stop enough to ask the why. And I think that's something that's really important and that philosophy is largely about. It's certainly about the how as well, but mm-hmm. the why is so critical.
Right. And that's also very current. It's a really relevant question right now as you hear the finding your why through the Simon Sinek videos and books and people really talking about what drives us, what motivates us, how we can use that motivation to positively improve our communities. And so it is a big deal, which leads me right to my first question, really, about in terms of your story. What happened, what incident or conversation happened and when that made you, first of all, be interested in philosophy, but even before you knew necessarily that it was philosophy that you were thinking about?
It would be my dad, actually. He had this really magical way of helping me sort of explore the world through questions, I guess. It was very Socratic in his approach. So we'd be out, whether it was doing work together or out on a hike, and he would drop a little question in and then allow me to sort of mull it around a bit. And then, so he was planting seeds, I think is where that started. And it started opening up just in a new world and really helped to, I think, cultivate, I think, a very natural sense of wonder that was there, but really nurture that. So that was, I guess, the start.
And is then, there a particular time you remember, like a walk that you remember taking? Or I only ask that because I have a vivid memory of taking this walk with my dad. My whole family was with us, but my dad and I were particularly close when I was a little girl. And we were walking through the Maroon Bells in Colorado, and we had family visiting. And I vividly remember walking and holding hands with him, and he walked very fast. And I'm tiny, so these little steps, it would take two or three of my steps to, but I walked along with him because I just wanted to be next to him. And I have this vivid memory of him saying something about how important it was to be outside and look at the mountains and understand the beauty of where you were, no matter where you were.
It's beautiful. Well, and that helped actually trigger one walk that definitely stood out. And that would have been in Laguna Beach, California, on the coastline, which I wonder if that's why I also have such a strong draw to the ocean and the water. But we had shared many of conversations just walking along the beach, and oftentimes in silence, too. Mm-hmm. He was, I think as a child, I was always sort of a little unsettled because I was thinking the space needed to be filled with me, you know, responding or answering in some way. And it wasn't until I think much later in years that I recognized this, I think, really the value of the pause mm-hmm. and then that thinking. And he was a master at helping people cultivate themselves
and create that space.
Yep. Yeah.
I think that's what people forget when they want to fill the space mm-hmm. with conversation or questions or answers. I think they forget that if you're not holding that space open, then a person doesn't have time to process what's around them.
Yeah.
My brother woke me up to that. It wasn't that long ago, unfortunately. Well, I guess it was. I mean, because Jacob was a baby, so it was probably 18 years ago or so. So it was a long time ago. And I remember we were sitting in the car, just the two of us. I was visiting him in Denver, and the two of us had gone to run an errand and left the baby with Bob, my husband, and his wife and their new baby at home. So it's just Eric and me, and we're driving along, and I'm just yammering along. And he finally stopped me. He said, "Sarah, I feel like you always need to fill the space." And I remember the first instinct was to be defensive. Like, I don't feel like I have to fill the space. And then that was my first, thought in my head, but I stopped myself. And I started really processing what he said. And he was right. I was filling the space. And my next question was, why did I feel compelled to do that? Especially when I'm alone with my brother, there should have been plenty of room in there between us. But for some reason, I always felt compelled to fill that. And, there are all kinds of reasons for that, whether it was I wanted him to be impressed because I was always looking up to my brother, or whether I was just nervous and so I was just yammering because it was uncomfortable. I don't know. Yeah. But now when I'm finding myself doing that, I do stop myself and think, why am I doing this? What is it that's making me uncomfortable, and how do I change this dynamic? Hmm. So I love what you say about your dad and how he gave you that space.
Yeah, he did. And if I could also add to, I'm just thinking so he was sort of planting the seeds along the way. I certainly, my first formal philosophy class was in junior college, actually, with Arnold McMahon, who is actually a board member on our on the nonprofit now. So it's been really
Merlin CCC.
Yeah,
wow,
so it's
full
been,
circle.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. And I just, that was an intro to philosophy class that I took, and I was just blown away. I'm like, this is amazing. You know, it's like, these are the questions that, you know, I've been asking, and like, what? So it was so exciting. And I remember, you know, in class and even going home from class, like my mind would just not stop. I wanted to continually, you know, pick these things apart and look at them and see how they, you know, mattered in my life. And then, you know, fast forward, I ended up going on to grad school. And in fact, actually, yet another board member on Merlin CC was my graduate professor in philosophy, Angelo Corlett. And it's been really a neat journey so far. I'm really enjoying it.
So you're in that class. What's one conversation, one time that you remember vividly from that intro class?
So the first time that I sat in that class, or went into the first day of that class, I remember sitting in the back of the room, which is not unusual for me in general. I kind of like to take the lay of the land.
Was this your first college class?
First semester, yes, in college, and first philosophy class as well. And so the first day happened, we get the general intro that goes on, and I remember being super excited. I think it was a Tuesday, Thursday class. And so Thursday I come back and I look at the seat in the back. I'm like, it's front and center every time from there on. Like, I just wanted to be closer, and like, I don't want to miss anything. This is so exciting for me. So it was a different style for me. It surprised me, I think, a bit. I've always been an engaged student, but not to the degree. Yeah.
Not up front.
Yeah.
Right. That's a totally different thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you sat up front that day, the second day of class, and you're looking around you, were any of the other students as enamored with it as you were?
I don't think so. I'm such a dork too. So like, I recognized it, but I was so eager. It was just...
Did you make any particular friends in that class? I mean, beside the professor that clearly you had some depth of relationship following the class.
Mm-hmm. Oh gosh, this was so long ago too. Speaking of, There were a handful, actually, of individuals who I think shared a love for curiosity and the questions, mm-hmm. and I think we're very dedicated to trying to find answers together, new perspectives. So yeah, we had some study mm-hmm. groups afterwards, and we continue to talk about things in class, and like, oh, dude, check this out, look what I found, like, what do you think about this?
See,
and,
I think that's what college is all about.
Yeah.
That curiosity and that creation of a community around questions and curiosity, no matter what class it is. The reason I ask about that first class is I took an intro to philosophy class at Colorado State University in Fort Collins. And I wasn't thrilled with it. It wasn't super exciting. I was really excited to start taking my English Lit class, which ended up being not nearly as engaging as the philosophy class. But that's where I thought I was going to be enjoying it. But I remember one class period in particular where we were talking about that age-old question when it comes to God, and it was, if God is all good and God is all powerful, why does evil exist?
The problem of evil, yes.
The problem of evil. And it got the class really talking. And I remember that particular class. It's not like it suddenly was enlightening and that at that moment, I was going to love philosophy the rest of my life. It didn't have that kind of impact. But I remember the question. And over the years, I've continued to think about that question, the problem of evil. Hmm. And it's fascinating because I've never done anything like that since. I mean, I've read, of course, other books. Mm-hmm. But so I guess I'm just curious about where that was for you in that first class. I mean, what was the topic Or was it just across the board, every topic?
So the first class, at least the first portion of the first class was sort of the lay of the land, what philosophy right. is, and that's, we could have spent the entire semester, I think, discussing right. that right. in particular.
As but, you would know now that you're teaching it
sometimes,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, kind of what it is, but also I think the question that stood out for me the most concerned meaning, kind of what our meaning is here. In life, what ought we to be doing? Who are we? It was definitely an invitation to reflect on ourselves. So I think that was the thing that always caught me, because it's hard for me to think of a life without meaning, having the richness and depth that I would want it to be. So I think that's an important thing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And you continue to grapple with that.
Yes, absolutely. I do.
So tell me about, I'm going to go back to your dad. I'm imagining you walking along the beach with your dad. And as a young adult, now he was a philosophy teacher. Is that what you were saying?
No. He was actually a wildlife biologist and ecologist. He certainly had a love for science and philosophy. He, before he went on, was in the military for a short spell. He fell into the works of Aristotle and Plato and Socrates and Plato, of course, mm-hmm. And just loved them. And so that was, I think, kind of a background for him. And he just mm-hmm. loved the master of art of questioning and a curiosity about the world. So, and he was also a professor.
Do you remember telling your dad about your philosophy class or about choosing philosophy as your degree program?
Yes. And what's interesting is it wasn't something that it had always been there. So at one point, and when I was in junior college and then finishing up my BA, one point I was art and philosophy. And then I changed the art out after a few things to psychology and philosophy. Philosophy was always the constant. And I don't know if I ever thought, like, I don't know if I had actually ever articulated that philosophy was going to be my major. It was just like, this is my steady companion. It wasn't until grad school that I think that conversation happened, that, I'm going to go to grad school and philosophy is what I want to do. And my dad was not surprised at all. He's like, oh, well, it's about time.
So you remember that conversation with him?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So graduate school didn't come until much later. There was about a 7-year window after I graduated, with my BA, and I had some crazy experiences throughout the years then. But it was a big decision for me to go to graduate school, and in large part as well because my father's health at that time was really starting to move.
Fail.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So he had was struggling with Parkinson's, and I'm always going to get teary-eyed, as you know me well enough about this. But I think that process of being with him, I was his caregiver for, 12 plus years, almost 13 years until the time of his death. I think philosophy was that, so it was my companion all through growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And it became very, gosh, sorry.
Don't apologize.
It's the thing that helped me and certainly still helps me kind of navigate that grieving process. Because I think grieving started long before my dad passed away.
Of course.
Yeah. And so it was sort of a natural, like, well, yes, I'm going to be going to graduate school and I need to continue this. It's mm-hmm. kind of holding this craft.
So are you sitting next to your dad and grappling with this decision to go to grad school? I mean, what was the conversation specifically?
Well, yes. And I think I was grappling. I was sitting with my father. So at this time, we would have been back in Oceanside because we moved to Oceanside, California. We moved to New Hampshire for several years. He underwent brain surgery out there. So we made it back to California, and I knew I wanted to kind of start this journey. And I was grappling largely because I felt that I would be abandoning him. While I was going to school. So it was really hard for me. And I remember him, he'd just smile. He got the biggest smile on his face and was so pleased to hear that I would be continuing that portion of me that he, I think he felt that I put it on hold a little bit.
A little bit, you think?
So, just seeing his smile, I think, alleviated some of the stress. And then also his words of encouragement. Mm-hmm. And he's like, this is your time, kid.
This is a good idea.
Yeah.
So you applied to how many programs, or did you just already know exactly which program you wanted to go to?
I applied to 5 different programs. I was accepted to 3, and one of which was in Washington, which I was really excited about. But as the time kind of got closer to, you know, me needing to make a decision, where my dad's health is just, I didn't think it would work well in colder weather. So I kind of pushed off the other ones, and I decided to go to San Diego State, which was also the one that I was accepted to. And I'm so glad that I did too. It was an amazing, really an amazing program. And I received such a different style of training, equally wonderful and beautiful, very different than my undergraduate training. Mm-hmm. So, and that was through with Corlett, largely, and certainly many of the other professors there. Mm-hmm. But it was really, I so loved San Diego State University. I loved the philosophy department there, and some of my colleagues, and being part of that. It was crazy though, because of that 7-year gap, I'm going back. And so now the age gap was just, it was like so much time, like technology had increased, like different. So I just, again, I still sat right in front of the class. I'm in it.
Yeah.
But my mindset was very different. I think I was like,
this is what I want.
Yeah. Yeah. So right. It was a different experience, graduate school. And I loved graduate school.
So you remember your first day of your first class in grad school?
I do. Was very nervous, though. In part because I'd been out of school for so long, you know, and I was like, oh my God, I'm so rusty.
It's a different way of thinking, for sure.
Yes. Yeah. And I was feeling very rusty. I was feeling insecure, I think, in some ways. Am I going to be able to do this? And am I going to be able to contribute to this dialogue? And right away. It was almost like the same experience all over again. Yes, there you are, old friend. You know. So, yeah.
did you do any reading in between in those 7 years? Were you studying along that time, just, you know, inadvertently?
I was. And I think that actually contributed as well to this sort of continued evolution and desire to go back to grad school. I was doing some concert touring on the road as a kind of a manager of sorts. And my psychology degree came in very handy during that time frame. Dealing with a lot of different people.
Musicians.
And, yeah.
We're the worst.
Oh, musicians.
We're almost like poets.
No,
very dramatic.
But yeah, just a lot of different personalities. And I just, I think it was such a fast pace and such a go, that my only reprieve was to go in and read and dive into this world of ideas. And I found it so comforting and soothing. And I think that was, I continued to read.
So did you have one book that you reread multiple times during that time?
Yes, it is going to sound so dorky. Plato's Dialogues. I just, as honestly, like, I that book is so tattered and like
dog-eared.
Oh, and, yeah. And there's like literal
highlights.
Yeah. I love that book.
Sticky notes.
It is. And it's so, and it's like, I'm surprised it's the pages are even on there anymore. So,
wow.
It's such a beautiful world, that book. Every time I read it, there's something new. And in fact, actually, a friend of mine who just came out and did a workshop for Merlin said something that really resonated with me, is that the book, I think every time you read it, provides something new. But also, I'm new every time I read it.
Oh.
You know, and I think there's some truth to that. There's these layers of depth and perspective in that book that every time you turn the page is a new adventure. So
I bet a lot of people that kind of idea can resonate with them. Mm-hmm. The idea that it's, even if it's the same book and you've read it 100 times, you're coming to it differently, especially if you've gone a few months or a few years between reading it.
Yeah.
And you are a new person. Like what is the old saying about the river, that the river changes.
Can't step in the same river twice.
Right, exactly. And it changes. Yeah. And I think of our consciousness that way as well, that all of the experiences that we have from day to day and year to year, tragic and joyful, all contribute to our being different every time we reread something or rehear a song that we haven't heard in a long time. And we just catch different nuances because we're different.
Yeah, I was totally going to go to nuances too. Yeah, I think you start picking up different subtleties. Yeah, yeah, new subtleties and nuances that are there that you might not have seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so Plato's Dialogues. Yeah, that'd Plato's be my go-to. Dialogues.
I'm going to have to look into it. I haven't read that one yet, but I have a feeling a copy is in my very near future. So my last question, when we come to, you've decided to start this Merlin CCC here in Helena, Montana, which is a small town in Montana, very well educated, average resident is well educated because we have the state government offices here and lots of federal offices, but it can be very small and very provincial here. So I'm curious about the very first event that you hosted here, where people showed up, and kind of what you remember from that experience.
This is a great memory. So the first thing that I did here was a philosophy walk. And I think that's also kind of goes back to my walking with my father on the beach. That So I did this philosophy walk, and I remember my mom flew in from Alaska. And we were doing this up on the trailhead up in Mount Helena. And I put it out there, was kind of an intro to philosophy. I didn't know. I was frightened. I'm like, this is my first event. I have no idea how this is going to go. So we get up there and we're getting ready, and I'm there about 15 minutes early, and I'm waiting, and 5 minutes go by and there's no one, and another 5 minutes go by, and I remember looking at my mom, and I said, well, Mom, it might just be you and me, but it'll still be a great walk. And she's like, oh, yeah, that's okay. And she's being beautiful, you know, yes, and encouraging. And she just see my face just like, oh. And then out of the blue, this man will always hold a special place in my heart because of this. So this is Bill Hallinan. Oh, wow. Wild man Bill Hallinan.
He's so funny.
He is wonderful. This man who I had my first time meeting him comes cruising around the corner, jumps up and puts his hands on his hips, and he says, man in need of philosophy. It's like, am I too late? Have I missed it? I'm like, no, thank you. So it was just the three of us on our first walk, and it was wonderful. Like, I love it. And so it's been really interesting to see how, you know, this first walk with three people, my mom being, you know, one of those, right. Yes. Are now, you know, consistently 12, 15 people, which is a nice size. Sometimes
you don't want to go too much bigger than that.
Yeah. So I was like, gosh, it's been really neat to look back and just see how things have started to catch. And I don't know. I think philosophy walks are wonderful. And I'm using wonderful a lot, apparently. Just wonderful. It's a time of year.
Now you're going to get that song stuck in my head.
I think one of the reasons philosophy walks are so attractive to people, you're outdoors, is such a beautiful place to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But more so, I really do think that there's something amazing that happens in nature. When you're out, I'll often say this, that I feel like it facilitates the removal of boundaries. Like when we're on the trail, there's no CEOs, there's no... social boundaries drop away as well. There's no levels of hierarchy.
Labels.
Yeah, we're just people that are breathing, feeling, hurting, laughing, you know, and we're doing something together that's wonderfully vulnerable.
And the only physical boundaries are our own, exactly. Really, when we're out like that.
Yeah. So I just, I love the philosophy walks.
So the last one you did had at like 14 people show up or something like that. Is that right?
We did. Yeah. So we had two guest speakers for that one, Christopher Preston and Jim Williams. And so this was part of our fall philosophy symposium walk series on the environment, ethics, and stewardship. So what a really nice crew. In fact, one of the members was a 3-month-old young baby too. Oh. Starting them young.
Yes, of course. Well, as long as they're exposed to different language and different ideas, even at 3 months old, that exposure does have an impact in their neural development. So it does.
Yeah, it was wonderful. So that was out where I live on Merlin Nature Preserve. The weather was a little challenging, but hung in there with us. The last about hour of the walk, we had a temperature drop, a pretty gnarly temperature drop of about 10 to 15, right? I know, it's like, holy. But it was a great crew. Really, the dialogue was...
So I know you have a tendency toward being an introvert, that you recharge by being on your own, reading, soaking in the hot springs, or sitting here with me with a glass of wine without ever saying a word, and we've done that in the past. So I'm curious about that last one, and you're back in your place, and everyone's left, and you're on your own. How are you processing this? I mean, what are your thoughts behind the success of that particular walk, beside, you know, warming up your fingers and defrosting your toes?
So after everything was cleaned up, there was an outdoor classroom that was created. I went up to my memorial bench that I'd made from my mother, and I actually created this garden near the cabin, and I sat on the bench, goodness, for probably about an hour. I just sat in gratitude. It's been such a, like, just... I'm speechless, actually, where things are now from when we founded. We've only had our doors open a little less than 3 years, and it just, yeah. And it's one of those
serious
things.
Serious growth, yeah. Serious impact.
Yeah, and yeah. It's. I think there's a lot of truth in that saying that if you do what you love, like, it's never a job. Even if you're working 70 or 80 hours a week.
Yeah. Kind of living that right now myself.
Yeah, you can definitely relate. Mm-hmm. But how wonderful to be doing something that you love, and mm-hmm. hopefully to be contributing in ways that are positive and helpful. It's challenging, and I think the gratitude was just being thankful that I have this opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had such wonderful mentors in my life too. And friends who also would be mentors.
Support you and just be there.
Yeah.
Show up.
Yes. Show up.
That's a big one for me.
It is for me too. It is.
So I'm reminded of a few of our conversations, but one in particular when we talked about how we process. I processed by myself for a while. Because I have to have these thoughts in my head that are just, it's like a hamster on a wheel. It just turns and turns and turns. Speedy Gonzalez in there. He wasn't a hamster, right? He was a mouse.
He was a mouse, but we're
same thing in my head. It doesn't really even matter. Little ears and a long tail. And but afterward, I find that if I'm with the right person that asks the right questions, it really helps me process more the impact it had on me. So I can process the gratitude. I can process the things that I want to do differently next time. Mm-hmm. I can process the moments of joy that I experienced during whatever the event was or the situation was. I can kind of process that on my own, but it's not until I get somebody asking the right questions and demonstrating that curiosity that I'm able to fully process what my impact was and the impact of that experience on me and who I am. Have you found anything like that in terms of being able to, because it comes right back to that whole idea of people asking the right questions at the right time to make you mm-hmm. think differently.
I think that's happening right now a little bit, to be honest with you. I think you're asking some questions that I'm not sure if I had fully asked myself to a certain degree. I definitely need the time to process beforehand. Across the board, I do.
Same.
Yes. Right. And I think I need a fairly long, I have a long processing time frame. and oftentimes it involves me needing to write things down to slow down whatever's going on in this, the hamster wheel, as you call it.
Exactly.
But yeah, I do think being asked the right questions is really valuable, and even if it's, you know, working through the questions together, mm-hmm. and yes, that is it's happening right now. So yeah, I knew I was grateful, but I don't think I had actually. No one's asked me what I did afterward. No.
I find that when we know what we need ahead of time, we give ourselves that space afterward. So the reason I say that is I remember after my first No Longer Virtual conference, and my husband was there with me, we were in Atlanta, and we were staying through the weekend so that we wouldn't come straight back home to regular work. And I was still working my full-time job with the city at that point. So it was Friday night. We had finished and we went out to dinner with a few other people that were still there until Saturday. And Saturday morning, I woke up with the total monkey brain. I mean, hamster on the wheel in my head. If I do this again, I want to do it this way next time. And oh my gosh, I was already imagining the sessions that I wanted to host for a year from then and who would host them. And some of the people I had met during that time face to face for the first time that I'd been connected with for years online, I was thinking about what value they brought and what they could bring the next time if they hosted a session. And, mm-hmm. you know, I had all this stuff going on and, I woke up with that and I was kind of grumpy. I was not in a good mood.
Okay.
And I remember Bob kind of immediately jumping into, well, if you do this again next year, you should think about blah, 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 blah. And he's talking, you know, detail stuff that I just wasn't even ready to start processing out loud yet. And I had to tell him that I needed space for a little while before we started processing this together. Because he had been involved from the beginning, of course, mm-hmm. and had helped me host. He was my go-to through the whole conference. And for the next one that was in Denver this past February, I planned for Saturday morning to be quiet. I knew ahead of time what I was going to need for self-care. Mm-hmm. Told my husband what that looked like so that he would know and be able to support me in that decision and scheduling. And it changed everything for that second year. I didn't wake up in a grumpy mood. I did wake up with the speedy brain and all the ideas for the next year, but I felt like I could handle it. I felt like I had the space and that I was giving myself that care to say, you need this time to just be quiet. So that's why I ask you, because I think it's so important that when we have an experience that we know is going to impact us in some way, that we know what space we need afterward. And some people really need an immediate sounding board. Mm-hmm. I know that there are some people immediately after an event, they need to debrief and just let it all come out. I'm not like that, and you're not like that either.
No.
So that's why I asked you that question. I think it's so important to give ourselves that space.
Yeah.
Okay. Final question.
Okay.
What story do you want to share that you think really was a pivot point that impacted you in terms of what you do now? The thing that triggered exactly what makes you so grateful now?
So I'm going to start with the word, and then I'll explain what I'm meaning by it after. Community, actually. I think I always have been a fairly independent bird. I certainly live in a very isolated location, require a lot, not just want, but require a lot of elbow room and space for this processing, I think, that we're talking about, and a lot of silence. And I think there was a portion of me that felt that maybe didn't recognize as much. I think I felt it, but I don't think I actually recognized the value and importance of community as much as I have over the last 3 years. And some of that might also be because my community prior to that, in many ways, was me and my dad.
Right.
And so, you know, since he's passed away, I think I felt very alone. And so it's just been really interesting to see how that space has been filled in some ways with that sort of continuation of love and care, and how much I'm also receiving that from the community. It kind of makes me feel like my dad is still here in some ways. Like, hey, kid, don't forget. No one ever does. You're not alone. Like, right. This is.
When did you know that?
Earlier this year. So that when I had mentioned earlier the three C's, the collaborate thing sort of popped into being, but it was largely because I was thinking about community, and that everything that has been done with this organization since its sort of inception has been specifically because I guess I wasn't afraid
to make a connection with people, and it was returned. And that sort of collaborative effort and the, I guess just the community.
So what happened? I mean, what was your awakening this year, earlier this year, where you thought, oh my gosh, that's what I've been looking for.
Well, so the irony of it is that it actually happened when I was alone.
That's usually when that happens.
Oh, goodness. Well, okay, so it was actually an evening. I was playing... So my dad and I used to do these little jam band sessions where we'd turn on, big band or, I think this one I turned on Artie Shaw. And so we have a vibraphone and a little piano, and we used to just jam out and pretend we were part of the band. Look at us go. Woo-hoo. And we would have a grand old time doing that. And some months back, I had an evening. I was feeling fairly melancholy, and I decided I'm going to turn on Artie Shaw, and I'm going to sit here and I'm going to play the piano and see if I can get into this. And it took me a long time to find the rhythm and the harmony. But when I finally did, I think I've been really obsessing about this notion of harmony in general. But when I finally did, I think what I realized is that, this is such a full idea. I don't know if I can simplify it, in a way that makes sense. Sorry, to anyone else other than me. It makes sense in my head.
That happens to me a lot.
Well, I think what I saw, so I'll just draw a picture. When I was doing this and I realized, when I finally got in the rhythm, I'm like, yeah, I'm totally in it now. I'm jamming. And I realized, I was like, look at this. And I was by myself, completely by myself, but I saw a room of people. Mm-hmm. And just everyone jamming. And so I think it was just me thinking, Helena, this community... we're all part of this wonderful symphony. How amazing. it's sort of indirect, I guess.
I love that. The word community is meaningful to me as well. And I feel very much the same way that I've generally been on my own. I've always felt like I'm on my own. Never felt like I was part of something. Certainly not in high school. And definitely not as I got into college. And I had friends. I have always had great friends, close friends. Yeah. But I never really felt part of something. And I remember moving to Helena, Montana nearly 20 years ago and being very lonely. That first year was awful. It was so hard because it can be such a cliquey small town. Mm. And then I had a similar moment where I was actually by myself. But even though we're not religious Jews here in Helena, my family... We do our Friday night ceremony, where I light the candles, I sing the prayer of the candles. My family, we do a prayer over wine, we do a prayer over the challah, which is the braided bread that I was making regularly at that point. And it was more about the ritual. It had nothing to do with the religion in our household. It was about giving ourselves this opportunity to be together, have dinner together, be grateful for that moment. And I remember at that moment letting this prayer kind of pop up into my head. And just to backtrack a little bit, it was the week after we had had a birthday party for Jacob, our older son. And we had filled this house. This was probably 6 years into living here in Montana. We had filled this house with neighbors and friends. We had at least 50 people show up. And Jacob had agreed to collect food for food share instead of presents. So his friends all brought big bags full of canned and non-perishable foods. And the whole front entryway was just filled with grocery bags full of food for food share. And so that had been about the week before. And I hadn't processed yet. But in this time, as I'm saying the prayer over these candles, I have my hands over my eyes, which is the traditional way of doing the prayer. And I remember suddenly being filled with gratitude for the community that we had created ourselves. We weren't part of something. We didn't go to a church or a synagogue and become part of a community. We had created it. And I remembered this moment of hearing everybody singing happy birthday to Jacob and the roof coming off the house with the warmth and enthusiasm of singing the birthday song to our 6-year-old son. And so here I am saying the prayer of the candles. It's just the four of us at the table, but I'm suddenly filled with exactly the same idea. I mean, I don't know that I felt the same because I wasn't there with you, but as you were telling me that story of having the room filled with your community, I can imagine that that's the same feeling or very similar feeling to what I felt at that moment.
Yeah.
Community.
Yeah.
That we build.
Yep.
And we can do that anywhere.
We can.
I keep coming back to the idea that you said you chose to be open enough to allow people in. I mean, it was a paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. That's not exactly what you said. Say that one more time. Do you remember how you said that?
I don't. Did I say it like that?
Interesting. Not exactly like that, but you did say that you you remembered opening up to...
Not being afraid to try and make a connection.
There.
Okay.
Those were the words you used. Okay.
I believe so much in what I'm doing, and I think that it's such a valuable, I guess, endeavor. And so maybe that's kind of what gave me the strength to say, I'm going to do this. If I fail, I fail, but I'm going to try. And it's been delightful to see so many people responding and being open and supportive. It's amazing.
Yeah, it just comes back to that same word, community. Yeah. And connection.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm surprised one of those three C's isn't connection.
I know. I'm going to add a fourth one on. I was going
It'll be Merlin quadruple C.
Yeah, exactly. I was
or
like,
C squared.
C-cubed. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, maybe that's embedded in the collaborative, the inclusive aspect.
Not being
of it.
Afraid to... to connect, to be part of a connection, and to...
and also I think there is a not being afraid to fail on this one. I believe it enough, and it's gonna happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's yeah.
What a great story. And I know it's just gonna continue to grow because you believe so strongly in it, but also because you've created a community that trusts you to bring this to us. And I think, I mean, maybe C squared T, I don't know, because trust is so important. And that's your brand. That's how you come across, that people can trust you. And you're bringing forward this opportunity for people to learn about themselves and about the world around them in a different way, coming at it from a completely different perspective. Because philosophy isn't the way people commonly think about their thoughts. They don't come back to Socrates and Aristotle. So I'm grateful for what you've brought to our community and to our family, of course. So thank you.
Thank you.
So thank you to Marisa for being my guest today. It's been a pleasure and an honor. And I'm looking forward to hearing from our audience kind of what they get out of this conversation as well. So thank you.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you for listening to Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Share Them Will. Please visit my website for more podcast episodes, blog posts, and information about how I can help you develop and share your stories at elkinsconsulting.com.
Could you tell me that you're going away?